This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins, my two wonderful producers. Well, of course, you know the drill. We begin every show, as we have now for a couple of months, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, as he testified in the fall of 2019 at the impeachment hearings. We've learned a lot about him over the course of the last couple of months, and we know he's a twin. We know that he and his brother were escorted out of the White House. We know he assured his father that things would be okay because this was the right country where you could sort of speak truth to power. And what we have learned, unfortunately, is that with Donald Trump in power, truth is expendable. So now, the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If it's Friday, I think we have to travel to Texas. Why? Because we have to check in with Scott Braddock. He is the editor of the Quorum Report, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, the voice of Texas. And as we know, as Texas goes, so goes the country. Now I'm getting really nervous.
Oh, no.
Anyway, so Scott, you sent me a list of topics, and I want to remind everyone that we Zoom on Thursday, so if something should happen Thursday night, we're not going to be covering it on Friday. But I have actually been hearing about this, and that is about what's going on with mail-in voting in Texas, and what is your indicted attorney general suggesting, Ken Paxton, because I read it and I'm still confused. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's the point, but maybe I'm wrong here.
Well, the indicted attorney general's made a lot of national news as of late. The latest thing was on mail-in voting. And we should start with this, Arnie. It is usually the case, it's generally the case, that the expansion of the franchise of voting is usually better for Democrats and limits on it is usually better for Republicans. Just so people understand why. It's one of those things where when you talk about this, a lot of civilians, if you will, people who don't pay as much attention to politics, people who are new to politics, would wonder why Republicans would want there to be restrictions on voting. Wouldn't they want everybody to be able to vote? If you start with the reason that it usually hurts them when more people vote, then you don't have to answer that question. You can go straight to what's going on here. And in Texas, we have, I've tried to explain this to national media. We have some pretty strict rules for voting in Texas. However, as Lawrence Wright, the great playwright and author and journalist, has pointed out, we also have 2 weeks of early voting in Texas, where a lot of states just don't have that. You can go vote. There's a lot of debate about whether it's something where the Democrats should say, Republicans are being so tough on this, you know, they're screwing you on your right to vote and all that sort of stuff. When most of what Democrats are hanging their hat on in these elections is trying to get younger people to participate. If you tell young people that something is difficult, do you think they're going to even try to do it? Probably not. Most of the Democrats I talk to around here in Austin say that the message should at least be voting is fun, cool, and easy. You should go, you know, you should go give it a shot. However, that doesn't mean that there aren't things going on with this. In Texas, if you're over 65, you qualify automatically for a mail-in ballot. And in this state and in a lot of places, voting is a battle of the old people. In Harris County, Texas, the largest population-wise Texas county, the average age of a voter is over 60. And that's both parties, by the way. You know, we still don't have youth participation.
And remind everyone what Harris County is, because Harris County is not necessarily an old county given its population in places like Houston. And I think people need to understand that the intent of this mail-in balloting for people over the age of 65 is to make it easiest for the oldest to vote, and therefore it's going to change the demographic when you look at the ultimate outcome.
Yeah, no question. Harris County is where Houston is. It's the third largest county in the United States, the home to the fourth largest city, Houston, Texas, one of the most ethnically diverse counties and diverse in every other demographic as well. The state of Texas is fighting the Texas Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party is arguing that everybody should qualify for a mail-in ballot, and here's the legal rationale for that. In Texas, if you are disabled, you can request a mail-in ballot so that you don't have to vote in person. And the Texas, this is my redneck version of the lawsuit, their argument is that if you are afraid of catching COVID-19 right now, you know, and the government's telling people to stay home and avoid certain businesses, even in places like Texas where we've started to reopen businesses, there still are all these restrictions and there's still all these recommendations, right, that you shouldn't be gathering in large groups and you should probably wear a face mask even if the state isn't mandating it, social distancing, all of that. And so people have a rational fear that they might catch this very deadly disease that we still don't know that much about. So the Democrats say that should qualify as a disability so that you don't have to go vote in person. You should be able to get a mail-in ballot and vote that way. The state of Texas has argued that no, the statute does not say that. And based on what the actual language of the statute is, Arnie, I'm inclined to agree with the state's attorneys on this. But that speaks to the kind of restrictions we have on voting. There was a judge in Austin, a Democratic judge, and of course we elect our judges in Texas. I don't know what y'all do in New Hampshire, but you can tell based on the partisan makeup of the courts which way they're going to rule on this stuff, and it's always like they will twist themselves into a pretzel to get to the ruling that they want to get to when you read what they actually come up with. Democratic judge in Austin agreed with the Democratic Party and said that voters in Texas should be able to request that mail-in ballot if they fear getting COVID-19. The state immediately appealed that to, and this is in state court, by the way. There's also a federal case on this as well. A hearing that is slated for Friday as this show will be airing, and we'll let people know next week what happens with that. There's a federal judge in San Antonio that's going to look at this as well as a voting rights case. So you have this judge in Austin says Democrats are right. It goes to an appeals court in Houston. The state sought to have it moved to Houston out of Travis County, the most Democratic county in the state. Then the attorney general did an end run around that, and he filed a petition yesterday with the state Supreme Court, which is made up of all Republicans, by the way. As I said, those justices are elected statewide. This is a Republican state. So there's not much doubt, Arnie, among political professionals how the state Supreme Court would rule on this. In all likelihood, they would go with the Republican and the state position on this, that the franchise should continue to be limited. Here's what the attorney for the Democratic Party said after Paxton, the attorney general, took this to the Supreme Court. He said, quote, after a month of thousands of mail-in ballots requests being made by Texans who are under the age of 65, the attorney general now wants to upset the elections process. There are a lot of Texans who have seen this legal battle playing out, Arnie, and have concluded that at least as of right now, they can ask for a mail-in ballot. So a lot of people are doing that. Now, in the meantime, the attorney general sent a letter to elections administrators everywhere across 254 counties saying that, no, you can't give mail-in ballots to people who are under 65 and also don't have what he considers to be a legit disability. This led to a criminal complaint in Dallas County.
A criminal complaint? Okay, keep going.
Well, check this out. So remember, in Texas, if you ain't indicted,
you ain't invited. I know.
So,
keep going.
So a couple of Democratic activists in Dallas County filed a criminal complaint with the Dallas County District Attorney, a guy named John Crusoe. And the short version is they're accusing Paxton of misleading elections administrators about their obligations under the Texas Election Code. This would be felony fraud, which, by the way, he's been indicted on securities fraud. So another case of fraud that would be investigated against the attorney general, potentially. The district attorney, of course, did not comment on that, but the state of play here, Arnie, is one of confusion. Now, as one of my friends
intentional. That benefits Republicans. Republicans, exactly what they want. They want confusion. And in a lot of ways, Democrats are aiding and abetting
that. In some ways, that's right. A good friend of mine yesterday said, think about just this week in California, Congressional District 25, that special election they had there, where a Republican candidate beat the Democrat, trashed the Democrat, mostly with mail-in voting. So why don't we, you know, roll the dice here in Texas and see how this goes? But it is absolutely the position of the Republican Party of Texas, the Republican-led legislature, the governor, and the attorney general, that if you are afraid of catching COVID-19 by going and standing in long lines on election day, and we have a couple of elections coming up, Arnie. We have runoffs for our primaries. We have the runoffs for those set for July 14th. There's also a special election for a state Senate district that's happening here in Travis County. There would potentially be a runoff for that. There's a crowded field for that state Senate seat. And then, of course, we have the general election in November. And do you think this is maybe going to be a high turnout general election, Arnie, that a lot of people are really fired up about this? You know, you see people standing in lines, you know, to get basic services right now. And what kind of lines would they be standing in November at their polling places? In the biggest counties in the state. And we should say that the attorney general took, as you alluded to earlier, he took special care to particularly warn those elections administrators, officials in the biggest, bluest counties in Texas, including Bexar County, Harris County, Travis County, Dallas County, et cetera.
Okay, so let me just say something. I'm really glad that you brought this up because I've been now talking ad nauseum about it for 2 weeks. In fact, I did it on WGBH, where I talked about the fact that you have two different interpretations of the fear of contracting COVID-19. Mm-hmm. In my state of New Hampshire, where we have a Republican governor who is surrounded by Democrats. Remember, this is very important. The Democrats control absolutely everything from the federal level to the legislative level to the executive council level. So he has now interpreted, although he doesn't like the idea of mail-in voting, he's actually vetoed bills about it. But because of COVID-19 and his concern about winning in November, he has now declared fear of contracting COVID-19 a disability for the purposes of getting an absentee ballot. Okay. And I then referenced what happened in Texas, where the exact opposite result happened. And my question is, and I'm glad it's going to federal court, because my question is, so when is a disability in one state, but not in another state? And that's exactly what's happening. It's even more confusing and it's more frustrating because why is my fear of dying of COVID of greater significance in New Hampshire and the fear of dying of COVID in Texas? Not a big deal. You still got to show up and vote. So it's just, to me, it just makes me crazy how it's being interpreted so differently. And we all may, you know, get very sick or die or become a vector for this disease.
As a friend who used to cover politics in Florida pointed out to me, Republicans have been very successful in Florida, which is thought of more as a swing state, of course, certainly than Texas. So they've been very successful with mail-in ballot programs. And you have a congressional candidate in the Houston area. You'll love this, Arnie. There's a Republican who is in that July 14th runoff that I mentioned, running for the United States Congress. Her name is Kathleen Wall, and you could do a whole show about her and her conspiracy theories and the campaigns that she's run in Texas. But she sent mail pieces to folks in the Fort Bend County, Southwest Houston area, saying that people needed to request a mail-in ballot, basically, if they fear getting COVID-19. So she's a very conservative Republican taking the opposite position. A little bit of a mixed message here. I saw where a former member of the state Republican Executive Committee, the governing body for the Republican Party of Texas, had called her out and said, why is she saying what the Democrats have to say about this? Not only did she send mail pieces out saying, look, if you're worried about catching this disease by going to the polling places on election day or during early voting, then you should request a mail-in ballot. Her campaign was also sending text messages directly to voters asking if they had yet requested that mail-in ballot because they need to do so.
Now, let me just ask one quick question and then I want to change topics. Yes, you can. Unfortunately, they are making
what I like to say is you couldn't make up anything this good.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So really quickly, you mentioned that there is early voting. What constitutes early voting? Does that still mean you have to physically show up in order to vote, but that it's kind of like a rolling election so that for 2 weeks you can just show up at the...
Do you not have early voting?
No, we don't have early voting. That's why I don't understand it.
Early voting is wonderful. And this is the case that Lawrence Wright, that author that I mentioned, that he was he was saying that, you know, Democrats often like to complain that we have such strict rules for voting in Texas. Mm-hmm. And he's, I mean, they're right. We do have some things, including the strictest voter ID law in the United States. So, for example, my driver's license will work when I go to vote with the voter ID statute, but a college ID won't. Now, why do you think that is? I mean, a hunting and fishing license will work. Mm-hmm. but some of these others won't. Why do you think that is? So it's not that hard to figure out, right? But early voting, typically in Texas, and it was, by the way, it was expanded by the governor for an additional week in the July runoff.
Okay.
Just yesterday or the day before, the governor had issued a proclamation saying that there would be 3 weeks of early voting.
Wow.
Typically, we get 2 weeks of early voting, which means based on what jurisdiction you're in, some of them do it a little bit differently. But for the vast majority of the 254 counties in this state, for 2 weeks, you can vote from 7 in the morning until 7 at night.
So in a lot of us, let me go back to some mirroring something. So what you've been saying is that it's actually because of early voting, some of the fear of contracting COVID could be minimized because you will have that 2 or 3 week period, depending on what happens, where you can walk in. It's not a line. It's not all those things. So it's at least if nothing else from a social distancing and wearing the right PPEs, you could be okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, in fairness to the Republican argument here, most of the time when I go, I always early vote in Texas. I just don't even worry about voting on election day. And there's always debate about that. Some people will say, well, I don't like to early vote because what do you know might come out about a certain candidate before election day? And then you're already locked in. Do you remember that during the, and I just don't buy that at all. To me, I think you should have conviction. Like, you either believe in the candidate or you don't. As soon as you can vote for them, you ought to go do it. Do you remember earlier this year, we were talking about the fact that while the primaries were playing out, the early state primaries were playing out, Texas started voting in the middle of that. And I think California also started voting in the middle of that. And so by the time Election Day on Super Tuesday rolled around in California and Texas, some of the candidates who had been running and that people had already voted for, some of those were already dropping out. And of course, it was before early Tuesday that you had the moderates get in formation behind Biden. And that's when you started to see those different candidates dropping out. And a lot of my neighbors, people who live around here and voted in Democratic primaries had said, oh, man, I feel like I wasted my vote. But I can tell you that when I go vote early in Texas, there's no line. I walk in and I walk out. And that's
And
that's right. most of the time. District Attorney Ronnie Earl is sometimes criticized by including by Tom DeLay's attorney. Travis County, that attorney had said that it's sort of a cesspool of politics. What he meant by that is it's the most politically active county in Texas. You know, turnout here is generally higher than in other places. So there are some times during early voting, I'll be very proud of my precinct because there will be a line out the door sometimes during early voting. But and that was the case. Right. That was the case during the presidential primary, but it's usually not what happens. Usually you walk in and walk out and that's it. And I could see them being able to do the deep cleaning and all of that. But there are those who are going to say, and I can imagine that you might agree with this, that the governor's extending early voting sort of as a ruse to try to say to people, well, people had additional chances to vote. And we sort of open the valve for the steam to get out here so that people wouldn't all have to be crammed into the same voting place on election day, anything like that. Right. And that's why we didn't need to expand mail by mail.
And I'm gonna step back and say, at least I want people to hear that there are reasonable alternatives. There are reasonable alternatives.
People can still vote.
Right. And it appears that you're actually doing it with people over the age of 65, which are the people that are most vulnerable to COVID-19. You're expanding the early voting. Mm-hmm. But then there are states that put you into a vice. Like Wisconsin, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, those kinds of places where there's so much unreasonableness happening that you can't even argue that. At least in Texas, it seems a little more elastic, and I have to give them credit for that. All right, so talk to me about Senator Cornyn. Now, let's remind everyone that I believe he's in election mode in 2020. Am I correct?
He is. That's right.
Okay, well, that I want people to hear that first before we then talk about the story that just came out this morning, Thursday morning, everyone, at the Hill about what Senator Cornyn is saying about Obamacare.
Really remarkable. He was being interviewed by the PBS station in Austin. He said when asked about people who have lost their health coverage, because look, we have we had new unemployment numbers again this week that are just breathtaking, Arnie. I mean, the amount of economic devastation that's being done now because of this pandemic. And your heart has to go out to the people who are not only losing their jobs, but I think Kaiser Foundation had a study this week that said that we were around, 27 million people who quickly lost their health coverage. Now, that doesn't mean because they lost their job, because we still have so many people who have their coverage linked to their employment, which I thought at some point we were going to have the grand debate in this country about moving away from that. And you've, how many times have you heard the politicians talk about portability of your health coverage and all of that? At some point, the soundbite just doesn't matter anymore. People still need to be working if they're going to have health insurance in this country. That's still the policy. So when the good senator, John Cornyn, our very senior senator, I always call him very senior because we have a very junior senator, Cruz. When he was at, when Cornyn was asked about the people who are losing their coverage, and I should preface this by saying Cornyn is somebody who has over and over again been one of those Republicans to carry the banner of repeal Obamacare, repeal Obamacare. Remember the repeal and replace thing that they talked about for a long time? And then as soon as the Republicans took over in Washington, they had no alternative plan. And at that point, they'd been railing about it for a decade or so, right, and then right. and then had nothing to replace it with. So they said, we'll repeal, then we'll replace. And I guess they would talk about how to replace it at some point. When he was, when Cornyn was asked, and this is why this is remarkable, when he was asked about the people who just lost their health coverage, here's the quote. I want to read it to you in full from the PBS interview. Senator Cornyn said, quote, the good news is that if you lose your employer-provided coverage, which covers about 180 million Americans, then that is a significant life event, which makes you then eligible to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. And as you know, it has a sliding scale of subsidies up to 400% of poverty. So there's an option for people, he said. The good news is people can find, get coverage under the Affordable Care Act or via Medicaid based on their income. This, Arnie, is remarkable. You have not seen John Cornyn, Ted Cruz, the governor of Texas, or any other Republicans that I can think of who are in elected positions saying that people should sign up for Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act coverage, or any of that for years and years. We have one, with, forget about the pandemic for a second, we have one of the highest, if not the highest, uninsured rate right. in the United States here in Texas.
Your badge of honor or dishonor, but keep going.
This state has, at a state level, has refused to expand Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act. You now have the elder statesmen, at least among elected Republicans, now saying that people who have been hit hard by this crisis, which he's correct, by the way, the law says, because, you know, there's an open enrollment in period for Obamacare that's typical every year toward the end of the year. So you can sign up right. for coverage for the next year. And usually we see this big push, at least under the Obama administration, we saw the big push to go sign up for your coverage. Now, of course, the Trump administration has pulled back on even promoting that. And they've worked to undo some of the progress the Democrats would talk about under the Affordable Care Act. But yeah, we've refused to participate basically in this program in Texas. And now the good senator is citing the law that says that if you do have a significant, quote, significant life event, something where you suddenly lose your job or whatever else, then the open enrollment period doesn't apply necessarily. You can go ahead and sign up for it now. So people could sign up for it now. He's correct, but I can't imagine a lot of Republicans agree with this. And as you said, this is the key. Cornyn is up for re-election this year, and this may be one area where he splits with the Trump administration. I haven't heard President Trump say anything like that, but I might double check his Twitter feed later in the day.
Well, one of the things I find really interesting is if Republicans are so wedded to private insurance and they're so wedded to keeping health insurance attached to employment, why aren't they funding a bill to pay everyone's COBRA costs?
All right.
People are finding out that, you know, that you could still get access to your employer's health plan, but you have to pay COBRA. And then you're looking at the cost of COBRA and you're going, wait, how do I eat? How do I pay right. rent? In a way, if they were to be truly thematic, I would love mm-hmm. to see Senator Cornyn say, you know, there's a real problem here. I think that I want to maintain that integrity of health insurance and employment. So I think we should fund a bill that says we'll pay for your COBRA. That will mm-hmm. then keep propping up the insurance industry. You won't go on Medicaid. He won't have to say those terrible words, Obamacare, mm-hmm. and he can be consistent. But you notice they never ever do. I have not heard a Republican say, let's fund COBRA. That's why they're absolutely, they're all hypocrites. They're all hypocrites.
One of the interesting backstories on the Affordable Care Act, as I understand it from some of my sources in Washington, you remember the way that it was passed through reconciliation, the way it passed through the House, then it was passed through the Senate, and then they passed it right on to President Obama's desk.
No Republican support.
Well, with no Republican support and with no conference committee. Right. In the legislative process, and you know this as a former legislator, when it comes to the negotiations between the House and Senate, the bill really gets written in conference committee in private.
Exactly.
Right? They and, you know, I know we don't have much time left, but basically the House will pass a bill, a version of it. The Senate will pass a bill, a version of that bill. And then each of the legislative chambers will appoint negotiators to sit down in a private conversation and talk about how they could change the bill to make it better and send it on to the executive for their signature or veto. And that didn't happen with the Affordable Care Act. And one of my good sources in Washington had said, and some of the senior Republicans like Orrin Hatch, like John Cornyn and others were expecting Hillary Clinton to win in 2016. And so it was their thought that they would then, with the White House, get to have a version of the conference committee to pass individual bills that would fix the certain things about the Affordable Care Act that they didn't like or that would make it better. But then Trump won, and so they couldn't do that.
I need to let you go, but I think this is fascinating. I just want to remind everyone, because your point is so well taken. You know, you ever hear that, what is that, that musical, How a Bill Becomes a Law? And yet you made a really important point, and we need to remind everyone. Everything that was really important to a bill does happen in the conference committee.
Yeah.
And part of the reason why it happens in the conference committee is that there is no public hearing. There is no public access. This is where actually the law is written in the darkness. It's written behind closed doors. And it is the most pivotal time. And people feel the most frustrated because the only people that have access to the conference committee are the most highly paid lobbyists, because they're really in the ear of those negotiators, basically saying, put this in, take that out, put this comma in. Oh my God.
Well, there's good and bad to that. People who actually know what they're talking about, and some of the politics is stripped away, but then there has to be a final vote on the bill, and that's where we get the final product.
And on that note, Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He is the voice of Texas. He is the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And if Texas politics is confusing, hey, it's now mirroring the rest of us. All right, talk to you next week. Thank you so much, Scott.
Talk soon, Arnie.
All right, stick around, everyone. Current Cast is next. And then we talk with Bill Curry from Connecticut. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott.
Too much and not enough water on this Current Cast. In the coming years, climate change will deal multiple blows to water resources in New York State.
So we expect more heavy rain events in the future, and that can have very negative impacts on water quality.
That's Radley Horton, a climate scientist at Columbia University. He says that heavy rain can cause sediment and pollutants, such as farm waste and pesticides, to run off into waterways. At the same time, rising temperatures will cause more moisture to evaporate from the soil, leaving it dry and creating a greater need to irrigate, despite the heavy rain events. So even though the state has abundant rivers and lakes, New York's water resources are not immune to the effects of climate change. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and of course with my two producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Joining us, as he does every other week, is Bill Curry. Bill Curry was a two-time candidate for governor in the great state of Connecticut. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He has written for Salon.com. He is a progressive policy person and commentator. And every time Bill Curry is on, I get all this email saying, have that Bill guy back. Have that Bill guy back. So I'm so glad that you're...
I myself write most of those, but go ahead.
I noticed. I kept thinking, wow, I think I see this email address before. Anyway, Bill, like every week, this is exhausting. It's exhausting because of decisions made by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It's exhausting because of what has happened with Bill Barr. It is exhausting because Donald Trump is throwing Dr. Fauci under the bus when it comes to issues of opening schools in the fall. I mean, there is no safe harbor. There's no place where I go, wow, stable, smart, science-driven, you know, analysis. It's all one minefield after another minefield. And I suspect that that's intentional, because as long as we're sort of bouncing back and forth from that kind of chaos, that may in fact help Donald Trump in November, because it means that everything else that is stable and normal as an alternative gets drowned out.
Yes. One of the things about the COVID experience is that the press covers it the same way they cover everything else that Trump's ever done. Every 2 to 3 days, there is a headline. And this is not an exaggeration. Every 2 to 3 days, there's a headline of a news or an opinion piece in the Washington Post or the New York Times that says, which reads, Trump's worst lie yet. Okay, there have been two this week, and it's Thursday. And of course, we all feel that. I wanted to write to all these people and say, listen, every day there's something that feels like Trump's worst lie yet, you know, and it's not. He can't tell any worse lies. He's hit the absolute bottom, you know, and he hit it in his first week in office, and he's never left.
He hit it when he was describing the size of the crowd.
Yes, that's right. He hit it on his but his lies are of uniform magnitude and perfidy. Now they may have worse consequences now. Some of them, you know, are resulting in deaths that we can measure the lies in real time. You know, we have actually people out counting the number of people who die from Trump lies. Whereas with environmental regulations, for instance, we don't.
Well, that's because it's slow death.
That's right.
What COVID-19 has done is given us instant gratification. Right. Dead in 14 days.
What will kill more people, COVID or climate change? I don't know. I know who's killing more people now. I know that COVID is presently the largest, the most lethal killer of all diseases, including heart disease and cancer in America. Right. And that their attempts to minimize it, their sick political attempts to minimize it, have cost lives. Thousands of Trump's lies have killed someone, and that's something to keep in mind as we cover all this. And
maybe it's also, Bill? Maybe that's the way to frame the November election.
Well, it is. Yes. First of all,
no,
it is.
Seriously. Here, I can be Joe Biden. I haven't killed anyone in the last 2 weeks. Donald Trump has killed this many people in the last 2 weeks. Who do you want to be president? The guy who hasn't killed anyone or the guy who's killed this many people? I mean, it sounds brutal, but in a lot of ways, you can actually do the math and compute it and show that that is exactly the result.
It is. If you don't mind spending a minute on Biden, there's so many things like this that could be said. I believe that we are slightly favored to win the election in November. Yeah, but if Joe Biden wins the election, the general election, he'll win it the same way he won the nomination, which is through no fault of his own. Joe Biden's consolidation of the Democratic nomination is something that happened to him, not something that he himself perpetrated. All those states he won in which he never made an appearance, hired a staff, or spent a dollar. The entire constellation of the Democratic Party establishment and sympathetic media and centrist media combined to tell people not to vote for Bernie Sanders, that it was the greater risk. And all of us, progressive, centrist, establishment types alike, all of us share that as our greatest concern, getting rid of the fascist Donald Trump. And so people made that decision about Bernie, the way he was portrayed. And Bernie made some mistakes himself. None of these people, you know, you can go through all of it. But that just sort of happened to Biden. And now it sort of reflects the Democrats' favorite strategy of my lifetime, which is to wait patiently for the other side to simply implode. And so we're doing it again. There was a piece in the New York Times about a week ago by David Plouffe and Axelrod, David Axelrod, the two architects of the two Obama victories, about all the things that Biden has to do. And they were like so many articles I've read by Democratic apparatchiks over the last few weeks. And they said he has to get a better social media presence and that he has to find better lines. It's not enough to do an interview or an op-ed piece. They have to have lines that go viral. And I'm thinking, yeah, lines that go viral. You mean good ideas? There has to be a good, compelling idea related to something someone cares about. And, you know, improve his social media. He needs to light his basement better for these. You know, he's not even, he looks, his Zoom pictures don't look as good as mine. He's running for president of the United States, and I'm a technophobe.
Right.
That's true. But the bottom line is, what do you have to say? And Yes, he has to get out of the basement. He should have done a public event a month and a half ago with people socially distanced, himself wearing a mask, showing Trump how easy that is to do, and that you can even make it look good, as Will Smith says in Men in Black, you know, I make this look good. And he could have been out there, and that picture of Biden modeling presidential leadership by wearing a mask in public itself would have gone viral.
So can let me just stop you for one quick second, and you're absolutely right, and I want to explode over that statement, because we need to understand how important that kind of modeling is, especially with what just happened with the Wisconsin Supreme Court. All right, but anyway.
I'll just wrap this up by saying, but the bottom line is, though, that you enter this debate. This is, you know, the Democratic Party is just like the media in their obsession that they've been so hypnotized by Trump. Trump is the hope diamond of shiny objects, you know, and they just can't keep their eyes off him. And they just can't keep this merely reactive kind of approach. Our great fault in 2016, in addition to all the bad things that happened to us, was that Hillary and her campaign and the Democrats were obsessed with Trump's ill character and talked about really nothing else and had no ideas driving the core of their campaign. Everybody remembers what Trump ran on in 2016, trade, the wall, and nobody can name anything Hillary ran on. Nobody. Hillary would be hard-pressed.
Yep.
never mind the rest of us. And so those two things, to go back to the Plouffe and in the general sense of the Democratic Party, yes, you need to go out and do better things. I'm shocked that he doesn't have people doing a better job of that right now. I'm shocked that having consolidated the nomination, having the entire array of Democratic forces now behind him, they can't do better than this. And I'm worried. I still believe we're going to win this based on the votes of people who simply want to evict Trump. But that's got to get better. But the heart of it is that they have to show people how a progressive message mm-hmm. can be presented to the center of the American electorate. Mm-hmm. And win. They're with us on the substance of almost every point. There are a few things to clean up to show that we're fiscally responsible, that we're not constantly engaged simply in cultural issues, but have plans to deal with the fundamental issues of economic justice and political reform. That's a winning case. It's such a winning case that Trump pretended to make it last time. We have to get that down. Here's the good news about Biden. His political instincts are so much better than Clinton's, for instance, that he is out this week, for instance, with a task force that includes some progressives.
AOC.
Reaching out on various issues. He does understand at least this, and even though it's the kind of instant insight that you associate with politics 101, consolidate your base, unite your party, treat the defeated within your own party with respect, understand how compelling their case was. I will say this to Biden. I really do about Biden. It's a good sign that he isn't taking the Clinton kick that dog to the curb attitude towards Sanders and his followers, which is what really destroyed her race. Not because they deserted her. She got a higher percentage of Bernie supporters, I think, than Obama had of Clinton supporters. Bernie supporters stayed with her to an amazing degree, but she didn't have the juice. She didn't have the appeal. She didn't have the message. She wasn't talking about anything anybody cared about. All she was talking about was what a big jerk Trump is. So I see Biden, for the one, the good news is trying to bring the party together and realizing he has to inject some of that message. The bad news is he doesn't really know how to do it. And so thus far, his campaign looks too much like hers.
But the progressives do know how to do it. And the fact that it's at least give them a door to walk through, trust me, they'll send a Mack truck through it. So in a lot of ways, even in his inability to sort of maybe sort of craft the right kind of quilt that we're looking for, you've got a group of progressives that realize here's the door is open. Here we have a pandemic that is exposing everything we have been talking about for decades. And yes, everything we've been talking about is being proven correct. All right. Right. It is absolutely true. You, no longer do you want to associate insurance with work. No longer can you say there isn't a difference in health outcomes if you are Black or Hispanic or if you're white, that geography matters, that wealth matters or lack of wealth matters. So in a lot of ways, a lot of things are coming to the forefront that are both useful and I think important. But I want to go back to something that sounds really crazy here. But you said that a month and a half ago, Joe Biden should have put on a mask. He should have held a socially distanced press conference and role modeled what leadership looks like and that it can happen. It works. It's not something that makes you like less of a leader by wearing one. In fact, what it says is that you respect the science and you respect others and you care about their health, which is why you're wearing a mask. It's not even about you. It's about others' health as well. So I was thinking about this. And you know what came into my mind as soon as you said leadership and masks? How absolutely attractive Macron looks in his mask.
He looks great.
He is wearing the most gorgeous navy blue mask with a little insignia on the side. I mean, we're talking like fashion statement. Macron looks stature enhanced, everyone. I just want to say this. I am not being crazy here. There is real import in this. And the reason I am saying it now and wanting to scream it when you mentioned Joe Biden should have worn a mask is what happened in Wisconsin when the Wisconsin Supreme Court basically said to, you know, Governor Evers, forget it. You don't have the authority, you know, to keep people in place and shut down businesses. So we're going to basically say that, you know, we're going to strip you of that authority. And what happened? People came streaming into bars. They didn't social distance. They didn't wear face masks. But the most disgusting part of the decision by the Wisconsin Supreme Court was the statement that was made by the Chief Justice. Do you know what the statement that was made, Bill? What happened was they were talking to her about the fact that there are still just incredible hotspots all over Wisconsin. And of course, where are the hotspots? But where the meatpacking facilities are. And she literally marginalized that as if to say, but they're not our people. She kind of made this comment that, you know, but they're not regular people, the people at the meatpacking facility. So what you're showing me as an example is something I don't value because I see those people as expendable and I don't represent them on the Supreme Court. It was disgusting. And to me, that should be made into an ad and run in every Black and Hispanic and culturally deprived community in the country and saying, look what came out of her mouth.
Yes. And as you and I have discussed, Arnie, there's a pandemic in the judiciary.
Yes.
And there is a pandemic of logical thuggism and partisan apparatchiks. The degradation of the American judiciary is astounding. And many of us began the Trump administration with the hope that the judicial branch was the one branch of government that hadn't been corrupted yet, through it, to which you could appeal for justice and which would enforce and uphold the rule of law. In vast swaths of the judiciary, that is not true. I know that, you know, a majority of judges in the federal judiciary have not been appointed by Trump. But he's getting close to me. He has majorities on many appeals courts now. And of course, he has a majority in the Supreme Court. That entire majority is due to fraudulent elections in 2000 and 2016. Republicans have put judges in place who are not principled conservatives as we understood the term throughout our lives. They are political apparatchiks. They are ideologues. They think that Ayn Rand is the founding mother of our country. You know, they just... You know, they confuse their own extreme ideology with the viewpoint of the founders, which is completely inappropriate and incorrect on almost every level. And yet there we are. And as we see with Bill Barr, and as we see in Wisconsin, it's not just the federal judiciary.
Oh, yeah.
And as we see with Bill Barr, it's not just the actual judicial branch, but the entire Justice Department of the United States, which is technically in the executive branch, which has been completely subverted and corrupted. Thank God, once again, one of the nice things has been that it turns out that what the deep thing about the deep state is that they're deeply patriotic. And that we've seen all these wonderful public servants come forward and tell the truth, regardless of the consequences. It's been when I need to lift myself up, I think of all the whistleblowers and all the civil servants who walked the plank for their belief in our democracy and in our constitution and our country, and I love them for it. I'm watching Judge Sullivan now in the Flynn case, bringing in a special prosecutor to make the case that the Justice Department wouldn't make. I don't know that he'll prevail. I don't know. I'm wondering now what they can do to silence him.
Right.
To stop this. But I am heartened by these people. I want to just bring this. There's nothing we can do about the judiciary now except make the argument that it's a reason for electing a Democrat. But there is something we should do in the future for all of this, and that is that we're going to need the Democratic Party, if we win, is going to have to commit itself to walk a fine line. All of the partisan corruption and direction, all of the intercession in the Justice Department by the White House, that has to end. That has to end immediately. Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing a Democratic president-elect should say, one of the very first things he should say, and the night he's elected, is that there will be no punishments or rewards to civil servants in justice pursuing justice, and that they won't be hearing from the White House anymore. At the same time, because of the depth of what's happened here, they have to say that we promise you that they will be empowered and authorized to conduct complete investigations. We won't do what President Obama did while the British were commissioning the Chilcot Inquiry and producing a public record of the lies that led them into Iraq in our wake. Mm-hmm. President Obama decided wrongly not to investigate how we got lied into the worst foreign policy blunder of our history and a war that has set off more misery globally than any single act of the last century. When he promised running that he would look at what happened on Wall Street to lead to the financial implosion, he got elected, decided not to do that or even to allow people to prosecute Wall Street culprits. The Brits, again, we should be looking to the Brits here. The Brits who were only responsible for that meltdown in a tertiary, they were responsible for Iraq in a secondary way, and they were responsible for the global financial meltdown in a tertiary way. They nonetheless, while we were prosecuting zero Wall Street criminals, they went to their financial community and prosecuted 53.
Oh,
okay, 53 to zero, and a full inquiry that made it harder for Britain and the Chilcot inquiry on Iraq to make it harder for Britain to ever make those mistakes again. Global financial implosion, Iraq war, it's harder to do that in Britain now than ever before because they looked back, they found out what was wrong, and they took steps to punish and to correct. We have to make a commitment on our side of it to begin to really uphold transparency by conducting full-fledged investigations, all of the results of which, and the opposite of what Trump's doing, hiding one report after another, one piece of information after another from the American people. We have to commit to full-blown investigations of what happened, starting in the Justice Department and throughout the bureaucracy, by the way, where, again, the Democrats have been terrible on this. Even if Trump is stonewalling, even if Trump is stonewalling witnesses on everything, not just his own crimes that we know of, but on everything about his administration, the Democrats should have started back in January of last year when they took over the House to subpoena every government contractor who apparently got a corrupt deal,
right,
and ask every one of them what they did and how they got there. Because this is, every government department is Teapot Dome now. This is the most pervasive, cancerous, wave of corruption.
That's a great headline for an op-ed, by the way.
Yes, that has hit this country in well over half a century, and possibly since the Gilded Age.
Wow.
And maybe ever, but certainly the most apt analogy would be the first Gilded Age. We live now in the second, and so we have to go back now and find out how this happened. Change laws so that corruption isn't so easy in America anymore. And we have to go back and find out how this Justice Department went from traditional conservatism to the service of strongman bully government. And that's the real ideology of the Federalist Society today, is dad can do anything he wants. And that's just not a way for a democracy to live.
I mentioned the Wisconsin Supreme Court Chief Justice. I actually have her words in front of me because I want people to hear this, because again, we're talking about what's happening with the United States Supreme Court. We're talking about the Federalist Society. We're talking about Bill Barr. And yet it has infected every aspect of the judiciary in so many places around the country. And I just have to read this to you because it makes me shake because I'm so angry. So after they struck down Governor Evers' stay-at-home order, Wisconsin Chief Justice, in responding to the hot pockets of spread found in places where meatpacking facilities were being operated, indicated that meatpacking workers, many of whom are immigrants, were not, quote, the regular folks of Brown County. It is, to me, the most vile and disgusting, and that she is the chief judge. You know, and as you heard from Governor Evers, it's the Wild West out there. But yes. I want to remind everyone that people from Wisconsin travel. They travel everywhere. They're now all going to be vectors of disease. So this isn't going to just be about Wisconsin. This has the opportunity to actually create such mass chaos in the Midwest. The place that thinks it's so safe is now going to become a toxic brew. And I'm going to lay it at the feet of the Chief Justice and remind her, her regular people die too.
If I could sum this up with two quick comments. First, also granted, more uplifting to read in that case are the dissents, all of which could be summarized with the following question. What are you talking about? And the Wisconsin, the Democratic appointees, they lost by one vote, just to see how stunned they are that the Republican majority could pretend that this was rooted in law. It's not. That's the thing to know. Judicial decisions are coming down by the score, and they are not rooted in law. It's one of the things at stake in this election.
I'm going to end right there. Bill Curry, thank you so much for joining us every other week. Bill Curry is a political commentator. He is a writer. He is thoughtful. He's the reason why we're so glad that we bring him on a regular basis, because we have to remember it's not rooted in law. What a great exclamation.
Not even close.
All right, ciao. This is the Friday.
Okay, kid.
All right, ciao. Bye-bye.
This
is the Friday Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and of course, with producers Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. See you next week. You better think.